Hello, Father Mark George is here. We are on day 9. We are starting chapter 2, Man as a Unity of Body and Soul. Once we have an appreciation that man exhibits spiritual functions, we are in a position to understand how great minds, grounded in implicit philosophy, have articulated this aspect of the human person using precise philosophical terminology. More specifically, we will base our discussion on the writings of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, whose works on this topic are timeless points of reference. Just as we can speak about a life principle as a principle of operations in animals that minerals do not have, in man there is a spiritual dynamism that is the principle of the spiritual operations of man. These operations are fundamentally the intellect and the will. With these also comes an awareness of self as a person. The spiritual dynamism in man is not an angelic one, but a human one, and it is called the soul. In the second part of the first part of the Summa, St. Thomas presents a thorough philosophical study of the human soul and its operations. The intricacies of this study are beyond the scope of this handbook. At this point, we can emphasize 2 points. First, the human soul has a spiritual nature, transcending time and space with the operations of the intellect and will. Secondly, man does not have 2 souls, a spiritual soul for spiritual operations and an animal soul for his body operations. There is 1 life principle in man for all his operations, both spiritual and bodily, and this is what we call the human soul. Using terminology from Aristotle, the body and soul are united in such a way that the soul is per se the form of the body. Here it helps to explain briefly the meaning of the term form that Aristotle developed. The form of a dog, for example, is like the mold from which all dogs are made. This may sound silly at first, but Aristotle is not referring to a physical mold, but to the type of life principle that underlies the active powers of a dog, like barking, tail wagging, seeking food, moving in packs, morphology, etc. These are observable to the senses. Science enables us to detect other active powers on a deeper biological and molecular level that further help us to understand the fundamental dynamisms of this type of life principle, in our case a dog, not any specific dog, but all dogs, past, present, and future. Extending the analogy of the mold, new dogs are formed by uniting the mold or form with a suitable material or matter. The matter takes the form of the mold and is inseparable from it once it dries. Yet we can make a distinction between the matter and the form it has received. Returning to the definition above, we can say that while we can distinguish clearly between the body and soul, in each individual human being, they cannot be separated but are united in a single reality. The rational soul is a single principle of life, and from it the body receives all movement, life, and sensation. A synthesis of this reality is presented in the Catechism of the Catholic Church as follows. The unity of soul and body is so profound that one has to consider the soul to be the form of the body. In other words, it is because of its spiritual soul that the body made of matter becomes a living human body. Spirit and matter in man are not 2 natures united, but rather their union forms a single nature. We have just read an introduction to the idea of man as a unity of body and soul. This is the core idea of this book. This book, Anthropology of Integration, basically takes this idea of man as a unity of body and soul, develops it, takes it apart, and brings it back together. That is how this whole book is structured. Well, we have identified 2 things, that the human soul has a spiritual nature, transcending time and space, but at the same time that man does not have two souls, a spiritual soul for spiritual operations and then an animal soul for his bodily operations. No, there's one life principle, and the Catechism affirms that very clearly using Aristotelian terminology to say that the spirit or the soul is the form of the body. Okay, let's continue. 2.1, manifestations and implications of body-soul unity. When we understand the soul as the form of the body, it becomes clear that while the soul cannot be reduced to physical chemical processes, neither can the body be considered as a mere instrument of the soul. We are not a soul inside a body, like a pilot in an aircraft, for example. Ordinary experience shows that we deal with our body as part of our very selves. When someone touches your hand, you say, "They touched me." When someone points at you, they are not pointing at your body, but to you. As they point, they may call your name, saying, "There is so-and-so." Our awareness of self, that self to which our name refers, pertains to the substantial unity and not to the soul alone or the body alone. The case of a pilot and a plane is quite different. Let us assume that we are speaking of commercial aircrafts. When we point to a plane, we can hardly say that we are always pointing to the same pilot. A plane and a pilot do not form a substantial unity, as is the case with the body-soul composite of human subjects. Planes can have different pilots and vice versa. This, however, is not possible with bodies and souls. Going back to St. Thomas Aquinas, the body and soul unity is so profound that there is hardly any operation in man where both spiritual and bodily dimensions are not implicated together. The means by which the intelligence acquires and manipulates concepts, for example, is through images that are provided through the external and internal senses of the body. When persons suffer from mental illnesses, the spiritual function is intact, but the malfunction of conduits in the brain impedes the correct generation of the images that the intelligence needs. In ordinary experience, when one is tired or sick, it is hard to think straight. Here again, due to fatigue in the brain, the images needed for thought are not effectively produced. Hence the importance of mental health and managing stress for proper reasoning. The will too must be aligned with the body. By its very nature, it seeks what will make the self happy. But the self, as noted above, belongs to the substantial unity of body and soul. It follows that the operations of the will, though spiritual, are related to the body at all times. When the body is tired and worn out, the power of the will to exercise control over the body is diminished. People are more irritable and impatient in those conditions and may yield more easily to saying hurtful things, for example, and to intemperance in food and drink. Such behavior is harmful to self and others. Confirming the unity of body and soul, medicine is increasingly aware that stress from work, relationships, and guilt, for example, is an important factor in some illnesses. What we have just read shows a few examples from ordinary experience that points to the unity of body and soul. For example, when you point to someone, you can't say, "I'm pointing to their soul" or just to their body. You're pointing to the unity of body and soul. So it's not like you're pointing to a soul alone, like a pilot in a plane, or body, you know, which is like the plane, which has a pilot inside. No. And also, we saw that the intelligence and the will need the body to function. The body provides senses, which gives the images that the intelligence and the will needs to use to function properly. And the body, of course, needs the intelligence and the will. The will and the intelligence is able to provide that, like that braking system, that navigation system, to enable, you know, a person to be healthy. You know, to be healthy, the intelligence has to figure out what is the right things that you need to do to be healthy. So we need to exercise our intelligence and develop happy habits all the time if we are to be healthy, even just from a bodily and a mental point of view. That's it for day 9. We'll see you again shortly. Goodbye.